It's an old bottle with a newer genie.
The risks inherent in disarmament pale in comparison. It's inherent in an unlimited arms race.
JFK talked about ending nuclear proliferation in 1961. 47 years later, the genie is nowhere near the bottle. Today, new questions about Iran's nuclear program. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, May 27th. Iran's nuclear program, is it for military purposes or domestic use? We'll take a look. Also, the longtime leader of Colombia's rebel group, FARC, has died. Could it signal a major political shift there? And a look at the life of iconic film director, actor, and producer Sidney Pollack. That and all the news. A report by congressional investigators will be released today saying the Department of Homeland Security is not doing enough to keep the nation's ports secure. The report says there are serious gaps in security that could allow terrorists to smuggle in weapons of mass destruction.
Chinese news agency says rescue workers are evacuating another 80,000 people due to flood risk. Troops armed with dynamite scrambled today to blast through debris damming a lake in southwest China, as forecasts of heavy rain threaten. And NASA's Phoenix lander spent its first full day in the Martian Arctic plains checking its instruments. It's preparing for an ambitious digging mission to study whether the site could have once been habitable. Peter Smith, the principal project investigator, says it's going to be interesting to find out what's below the Martian surface.
We're wondering on Mars, is there any indication that organic materials are preserved in this ice? And probably the organic materials would come from asteroids and comets that have hit the surface of Mars over the last eons, let's say.
Barring an asteroid hit, mission scientists report all instruments are operating well. It'll be another week before it takes a scoop of soil up there on Phoenix.
Already under fire for its handling of cyclone victims, Myanmar's military regime is renewing the detention of pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi. The military leader's also detained about 20 members of her opposition party today. It's not clear how long the extension will be. The junta has confined the Nobel Peace Prize laureate in her home for 12 of the last 18 years. In California, same-sex couples in some counties will be able to marry as soon as June 14th. That's according to the president of the California's County Clerks Association. The announcement comes after the California Supreme Court overturned a ban on gay marriage this month.
Legendary movie director Sidney Pollack has died. Pollack is being remembered as an actor's director. He earned an Oscar for Out of Africa and acted opposite Dustin Hoffman in Tootsie.
Nobody wants to pay $20 to watch people living next to chemical waste. They can see that in New Jersey.
He was an agent to Dustin Hoffman there, but as a Hollywood icon, he produced, directed, and acted in more than 100 movies. Oil prices holding steady at $133 a barrel in Asian markets. Any thoughts on the rough weather, crisis in Africa, death of Sidney Pollack? We invite you to drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or write us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Also today we're asking, is there a beauty premium?
Well,
can you think of a time when you or someone you know have gotten ahead because of their looks? We want to hear your story.
Yeah, and you're all over that.
I'm not so sure that that's true.
That's why you're here.
Well, we'll see what Stephen Dubner from
go to our
Freakonomics
website, see
has
how
to
beautiful
say.
Adora is,
oh,
and then talk
gracious
to me about the beauty premium.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. For years, the Bush administration has been warning that Iran is trying to build nuclear weapons. And a new report, John, from the International Atomic Energy Agency is really not likely to settle the matter. Agency officials say they just don't know whether Iran is trying to build for use or for military purposes, and that they concluded in April Tehran continued to rebuff their efforts to investigate whether the government is really pursuing peaceful reasons in its nuclear program. Iran's Vienna-based ambassador has another take. He says the report is proof that Iran's entire nuclear activities are peaceful. So where's the truth in all of this? Well, for that, we're going to turn to the BBC's John Line. He is joining us from Tehran with the latest. And welcome, John. The report says that Iran has ramped up its capacity to enrich uranium. Does that help in understanding whether it's nuclear weapons they're after or nuclear power?
Well, not really. Iran has been boasting, frankly, of its the fact that it's increasing its nuclear uranium enrichment program. It says it's for peaceful purposes. In fact, if anything, I think the belief is that Iran is probably exaggerating its capacity for uranium enrichment. In a way, it's a challenge, maybe even a provocation to the West, to insist that Iran will push on with this program. But Iran then continues to say it is for peaceful purposes.
And what about this notion that they refuse to allow UN inspectors to see these upgraded centrifuges or to cooperate, that the Iranians are not cooperating with their efforts to understand exactly what they're doing in regards to nuclear power or weapons?
Well, there's a few issues there. Iran has cooperated to some extent, and I think the IAEA makes that clear. For example, Iran showed the IAEA their new P2 centrifuges, the new modernized versions. They showed them very early on to Mohammad al-Baradei. But the IAEA, the nuclear watchdog, says they haven't been shown enough and there haven't been enough detail, both of the current program to enrich and this historical issue of whether Iran was trying to make or design nuclear warheads back before 2003, the period the United States say Iran was actively trying to get nuclear weapons.
John, give us a picture of what the nuclear facilities are in Iran. It's my understanding that there are two facilities, one in the Natanz and one at another location. One is very clearly designated civilian. The other is a little more mysterious. And on the inspection issues, isn't it true that Iran prefers to show prototypes or small pilot projects to the IAEA, leaving the actual production facilities kind of out of the inspections regime?
No, I don't think that's quite fair. There are a wide range of nuclear facilities here in Iran, and that's always been one of the issues about why it would be so difficult for any kind of military action to take out the nuclear program here without a really widespread program of attack. For example, you've got the main enrichment facility at Natanz, but then you have other things in Isfahan, the big city, the historical city of Isfahan. You've got the nuclear reactor at Bushehr, which is nearing completion. You've got the heavy water facility, which could be associated with a plutonium-powered bomb in Iraq, and other facilities across the country. So it's not like the situation, for example, when the one reactor in Iraq at Ozirak was bombed back in 1981. So there are a very wide range of facilities here. And yes, the UN has shown the Natanz nuclear enrichment facility, which is the most key facility because that's the facility the West believes could be used to make nuclear material and ultimately nuclear bombs. They have shown it to the IAEA, and it is monitored by the nuclear watchdog. And the interesting thing really is actually that the previous reports from the IAEA have actually said that Iran is not proceeding as fast as Iran claims to be proceeding. Iran says, we've got these centrifuges going, they're all working well, we're ramping it up from 3,000 to 9,000, whereas the message you get from the IAEA in Vienna is, actually, they're not working so well. It's a very difficult technical program, and they're not working so fast.
Certainly Iran gets more out of claiming nuclear capability than actually producing nuclear capability with their reaction from the West. Politically, it's important for them to make these exaggerations, it seems.
Oh, yeah, it's quite clear. I think it's very hard, and even officials I've spoken to here have conceded that whether or not Iran is actively trying to make a nuclear bomb, and of course Iran always denies that, nevertheless, this is a highly political program. It is a challenge to the West, even if no bombs were ever produced. The point is, if you like, somebody once said to me, if America stopped objecting to it, Iran would stop doing this immediately. Now, that's a bit of a joke, but I think I get the point.
Very quickly, John, this report was the result of a UN Security Council request. What happens next?
We proceed on. I think Iran is in no mood for compromise whatsoever, although an EU delegation is expected here soon. Iran is in absolutely no mood for compromise. And from the other side, I haven't frankly seen any sign of a clear policy from Washington to take this forward. It's very hard to get new sanctions through the UN, and at the moment, military action certainly seems to be off the table.
John Line for the BBC, reporting from Tehran. Thank you.
We're going to look ahead now and turn the page. In an election year full of tension, conflict, and anticipation, we've got a pair of conventions this summer. That's no surprise. Denver and the Democrats go first, and there have already been numerous comparisons with the chaos and protests from the 68 convention in Chicago. Minneapolis and the Republicans will follow this summer, and the GOP, associated with an unpopular war, has its own worries about security. Both cities are apparently consulting with the New York Police Department on how to prepare for their conventions. New York City was the site of the 2004 Republican convention, and the NYPD's aggressive and preemptive tactics with protesters 4 years ago were expensive and remain controversial. Are they a good model for 2008? WNYC's reporter Bob Henley covered the 2004 Republican convention. He joins us now to break down what the stakes are in this season and whether the NYPD is a template for Denver and Minneapolis. Bob, thanks for joining us. What do you think?
Good morning. Well, I guess in the case of New York City, they've paid out some $1.5 million since the events of 2004 in terms of tort claim damages against people that were arrested who were convicted of no crime. There are 80 unresolved cases, all kinds of litigation, including a landmark case where the New York City Liberties Union is trying to get a hold of documents to flesh out the heretofore undisclosed New York City police intelligence effort, which is apparently global in scope.
Let's describe those tactics. Could we basically the court documents paint a portrait of the NYPD acting very preemptively, infiltrating groups in advance of the convention, and then the arrest tactics meant they were throwing a very, very wide net. Is that correct?
Well, actually, they were using a net in some cases. The question, they took into custody some 1,800 people. Very few of the charges stuck. The civil liberties groups contend that this amounted to preventive detention because the people were, unlike prior demonstrations in New York City where civil disobedience was involved, people were processed and kept in the system much longer than people who had done, crimes. And so from the civil libertarian point of view, this was, like I say, a preventive detention. Once George Bush left New York City, then they were released. And then in many cases, local judges tried to get access to these people. They weren't produced. Now, on the other side of it, there are people, including Mayor Bloomberg, Police Commissioner Kelly, and I might say other people in law enforcement around the country who look at the RNC as a model of hundreds of thousands of people did come to New York City to protest, some 400,000 at that one big march. And so they look at it like everyone came to express themselves, and they did. And the only serious injury that day was a police officer on a motor scooter who was knocked down by a protest.
Well, let's see what Denver officials are thinking of when they're looking to the NYPD's tactics here. Here's Mark Silverstein, who's a Colorado ACLU lawyer, who's talking about his suspicions about the Denver Police Department in anticipation of this convention.
Several years ago, we obtained documents that showed that the Denver police were systematically gathering information on how law-abiding advocacy organizations were exercising their First Amendment rights, keeping files on those organizations and their political activities.
Now, is that related specifically to the convention? What does
no,
that tell
it's
you?
No, it's not. It's something that really informs the atmosphere. There was something called the Spy Files cases, which was resolved back in 2003. The Colorado civil libertarian groups were able to document that the Denver police were keeping records on such radical groups as the American Friends Service, and in many cases inaccurately characterizing them as potentially dangerous. And so there was a resolution of it, a consent decree, if you will, like a stipulation between the police department and the civil liberties groups that they would reform this process. The problem is that there's a kind of suspicion out there about this. The terms of that agreement ironically end in 2008, right in the midst of setting up for the convention. So there's a kind of paranoia on that part. And that's another thing very important here to keep in mind is trust is a very important thing to establish for all the people involved in this, both the protesters and the police.
Thanks, Bob. Bob Henley covers police and security for WNYC Radio in New York. We haven't even talked about inside the convention, where the credentialed delegates will have plenty of tension there as well. Bob Henley, thanks a lot.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's May 27th, the day after Memorial Day, and we're following a couple of stories today. Well, many, many stories, I should actually say. The International Atomic Agency's report on Iran's nuclear program. Also taking a look at what's happening in Colombia after the militant rebel group FARC's leader died, or at least it was announced he's died. And we're also welcoming back our friend, Stephen Dubner.
It scares me
Freakonomics
when Dubner comes in here.
Author and
scares me.
Author
I aim
of
to
the
swear.
Blog.
Did you notice he wheeled a file cabinet in here? It's like he brought the public library.
I think you're exaggerating a little bit, John.
No.
But he did bring in a computer. So
His lap. He's got a laptop.
You guys cheat. Do people see you on the air? They know that you're sitting there with your computers online. And the guests
computers.
Come in at a huge disadvantage.
Off
we're
top
just
of
working
my head
off our
head.
All right,
top
gentlemen.
Of my head.
All right, gentlemen. Memory. Calm down right, so we can at least
today?
Tell folks what we're
today?
Talking about.
What are we
talking about first impressions. Is there a correlation between how you look and your success in life? Some people think so, but based on what? And Stephen is here to lay out the studies, making the case that your ability to make it in this world is directly proportional to the gifts that your mother gave you.
Yeah.
Okay, welcome.
Yeah.
All right, Stephen, welcome and lay out that case for us.
Thank you. So one thing I would say, it's a little bit different. It's not necessarily first impressions, although, yeah, you're right. A big piece of it surely is. It's what economists call a beauty premium. In other words, you get a premium in your lifetime wages. You are going to earn more if you're good looking. You're going to earn more if you're tall, especially if you're a man, and you're going to earn less if you're, as the economists like to call it, plain looking, but the frank economists will call it ugly. So there's an ugly penalty and
measure,
a beauty premium.
I mean, beauty, as we all know, is in the eye of the beholder. I mean, beyond the supermodels, Giselle or Naomi, they get a premium, obviously, because of the way that they look. But beyond that, for the masses of us, how do you measure who's attractive and who isn't, and then figure out why they are making more money or less?
Well, you do. Okay, so that's a great question. It's a two-part question. The first part is, how do you measure it? You do your best. And the way you do your best is you take pictures of people, let's say in a big pool. Let's say you go to a company like GE where you know the wage, you know, or you take as big a pool of data as you can, many companies. You take pictures of the people that look about the same type of picture, and then you bring in a panel of objective looks graders. They're usually students that do these experiments. Give them a scale of 1 to 10, and then you see the looks. Then you try to correlate those things to wages. So that's one. The other thing,
and
though,
companies just let you come in and do that?
Well,
they let you wander around with a camera and then look at all the salaries?
This is why scholars love things like Facebook, for instance, right? You're always looking for instances in which data can be repurposed to suit your evil needs. Right?
So let's talk about the actual dollar amounts. Tell me how much more someone makes if they are considered attractive. Give us some solid numbers here.
So Dan Hammermesh, who's an economist at the University of Texas at Austin, I believe that's right, has done a lot of work in this area. He has established that a beauty premium for men is about 5%, and the ugly penalty is about 9%, minus 9%.
That's salary.
Salary, lifetime wage.
Lifetime wage, okay.
Now, there are other elements of this. There's height, there's teeth, right? There's all different kinds of pieces. All these different separate kinds of researches.
The height of your teeth?
That's
well. That was unfair. I'm wasting your time. Please go.
Yeah, I'm wasting yours too. That's okay. But here's the thing. Let me say this. All these beauty and beauty premium ugly penalties, these all pale in comparison to the larger discriminations against, let's say, obesity, against race in certain cases, okay? So what you have to remember is these guys, economists, are trying to measure sort of around the margins. There are some big obvious things that we can really see and know.
And some of which,
but they
some
don't
of those things
other,
are actually illegal.
Exactly. These are not. You can't – it's really hard to nail someone for not hiring the ugly people. Okay, and so that's anybody, why
has that ever happened to you? I notice you're a freelancer now, which probably means
you're saying ugly.
You've had some tough moments with
Adora,
HR.
What have you been feeding you this morning?
I'm not. This is why I just have. I find this all problematic, to be honest with you, because there are so many variables that you cannot account for, and I realize that there are all these studies that say taller men make more money, but when you look at all of the billionaires, many of whom I've actually seen in person here in New York, they're not tall. In fact, most of them are very short.
Here's the problem.
I don't hang out with them. I just see them on the streets. We live in New York City. There are a lot of people who are very rich here.
So here's the problem.
So how do you figure that out?
This is why people often hate this kind of study, and I sympathize with this. It is about typical. It is about average. It's a generalizable result. The minute you tell me X is true, I can say, but wait a minute, I know why. I know Mike Bloomberg's one of the richest guys in the world, and he's, you know, four
short,
right?
He fits in a hamster cage. I mean, he's small. I mean, he's a small guy.
I had nothing to do with that comment.
Let's not make fun of our mayor.
But the fact of the matter is that, yes, tall men earn considerably more than average men. Now, there are a lot of theories for that, all of which are interesting, one of which has to be true because the fact is true.
Which is?
The fact it's true is that tall men earn more. The theories are...
And we're talking 9%, right?
Tall is a little bit different than beauty. Yep. Beauty and height are different. Tall men do well. Look at our... that's a famous example. Our presidents are tall. Now, we can say why. Might be a lot of reasons why. One might be that height inspires confidence in people, especially voters. It might go back to our caveman days. We want the big guy out front beating in the skulls of the other caveman team, okay? Mm-hmm. It also could be there's a theory that height in adolescence for men is very important because that's when you gather up and gain your self-esteem.
So, that's great. So we're going to come back to that in a minute. Presidents and tallness and smartness, much more to talk about there with Stephen Dubner. We'll be back with that in a moment. But right now we're going to the tall and beautiful Femi Okay, some more headlines.
And Adora's laughing.
I'm just
understand.
Laughing because John just couldn't resist.
And also, what? He forgot to mention my blonde hair.
Correct. No, I'm just, it's factual.
It's 29 factual. Minutes past the hour. In the news this morning, Myanmar officials announced that Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi's detention has been extended. Rescue workers in central China are hurrying to evacuate 80,000 people at risk from flooding. And in the US, Barack Obama heads to Nevada, while opponent Hillary Clinton is in Montana. President Bush today is in Phoenix, where he'll give a speech talking up trade as a way to help improve the economy. He'll also be stopping by three Phoenix area homes to raise money for fellow Republican John McCain. In business news, Toyota has become the world leader in gas electric hybrids with its popular Prius. More than a million of the high mileage cars are on the road. Toyota says it's building a third plant in Japan to make batteries for eco-friendly hybrid cars. And finally, some sports news for you. The NBA's Eastern Conference Final is tied at 2 games apiece. The Detroit Pistons beat the Boston Celtics 94-75. And that's a look at your news from around the world and the U.S.
Great for Detroit, tough for Boston there, but that's a series to watch.
Yeah. It's not over yet.
The Lakers are romping out on the West Coast, but more NBA, more sports. Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
So what do you think?
Good for the Pistons.
Good for the Pistons.
Yeah, they've been suffering in Michigan, and so they need some good news. And they're
Ann
not doing
Arbor,
too bad
biased.
On the, they're not doing too
you're
bad
biased.
On the sports front.
Detroit? No, they're in the Stanley Cup Finals.
Well, the Stanley Cup Finals, and now they
look
like
they
might
team?
Go to the...
Do you know the hockey team?
Yeah, absolutely.
What is it? What's the name?
We're out of time, John. Red Wings.
She did it!
You helped her. The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Father's Day, a short film about a woman whose father left her when she was a child, and her daughter, who now wants to meet her estranged grandfather, if he lives long enough. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. We may be chuckleheads about this beauty premium idea, but we definitely are interested in your stories. 877-8-MY-TAKE is what we want to hear from you. MyTakeItToTakeAway.org. You can email us like Chris Taylor did. He emailed us at MyTakeItToTakeAway.org. I've noticed that larger churches and mainline denominations tend to have tall, handsome preachers. It's uncanny. Search committees are looking for inspiring preachers and able administrators and somehow wind up with Reverend Brangelina types. A study could easily be done among a graduating seminary class comparing conventional measures of attractiveness and then salaries 10 years later. We'll put Steve Dubner right on that one.
Well, and Rich writes, interestingly, that with regard to the link between a man's height and his earning capability, you've not mentioned the possibility that it's not so much a matter of causation as correlation. Perhaps boys who were better fed at an early age had better education and were able to grow taller. So maybe there's some genetics in there, too.
Yeah, well, or at least nutrition. Dubner was talking about a correlation, though. It's interesting. The correlation is the whole key here.
So we're taking your stories at 877-8 My Take. In the meanwhile, though, we're going to move on to what's going on in Colombia. This weekend, Colombian rebel leaders confirmed that the top commander of the notorious Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, that the leader, Manuel Marulanda, died in March, a long time ago. Some see this as the latest sign that Colombia's president is gaining the upper hand with a group that is known primarily for handling much of the cocaine that enters the United States and for the many hostages it's taken over the years and is still holding. Naomi Darren Blum is a professor of Latin American politics and development at the New School here in New York City. Naomi, welcome. The leader of the FARC is said to have died from a heart attack. Is there any way to know for sure that's exactly what happened and what this means politically?
We actually have no idea to both of your questions. He died supposedly on March 26th, and we only discovered this almost by accident in an interview that the defense minister, Juan Manuel Santos, gave to the weekly Semana. And it was a very offhand comment. They were talking about the peace law, and the ability to demobilize the guerrillas, and all of a sudden he sort of threw away this line that Manuel Marulanda is in hell. And the interviewer says to him, what do you mean? He says, well, you know, he's in hell where all the guerrillas who are dead will be. So this is how this came out. It wasn't a sort of statement by the government saying, you know, the leader of the FARC is dead. So afterwards, the FARC came out and confirmed that he had died from a heart attack. But because there have been so many military operations in the areas where the FARC is, we really don't know if he died really from a heart attack or if he was killed in some sort of operative.
Now, this is Colombia's largest guerrilla group. And in the last year, four senior commanders have been killed, and another surrendered this month, came out saying, a woman deserter who said that the organization is crumbling. Any more evidence of that?
Well, Udara, that's a great question. The reason that is so that the death of Marulanda now comes both as such a surprise, it's because this is really a critical moment. There have been problems with finances, problems with communications, political problems within the group. When Karina, the rebel that you mentioned, surrendered in this past week, she gave lots of interviews to the Spanish TV and different newspaper organizations in Colombia. She said that she hadn't talked to anybody in the secretariat for the last 2 years. So there is a sense that military operations that the Colombian government has put into effect in the last year or so are really taking a toll. In the interview that the defense minister gave to Semana, they asked him very directly if Alfonso Cano, who was the leader of the Occidental Bloc at the time, had been cornered. And he says, no, he's not cornered. And now it turns out that Alfonso Cano is the leader of the FARC.
And he is also coming from the political wing, which
absolutely
may sound a different note or potentially a tone in with which the group will now move forward?
Well, Dora, there are two views on this. The head of what is supposed to be the military wing, Mono Jojoy, is actually there seems to be a power struggle that we haven't really seen. In the press release from the FARC, they said that Alfonso Cano was chosen by unanimity, but Cano really joined the FARC in '82. He is an anthropologist, He had a meteoric rise within the group. By 84, he was already negotiating with the government of Belisario Bentancur. So he's seen really as the political leader. He heads the sort of political front, which is a party that was founded in 2000 called the Bolivarian Initiative for the New Colombia.
Naomi, quickly, what do you think the regional implications are of this? What's the next move for Hugo Chavez? What do you think the relations between Colombia and its neighbors are going to be based on what appears to be a decline of the FARC?
Well, there was a meeting this week for UNASUR in Brazil, which is the union, the future union of South American countries that could turn into a European Union. That's the hope. And apparently there was a very cordial meeting between Chavez and Uribe. There is a worry here in policy circles in the United States that now that it looks like there might be a defeat of the FARC militarily, that Hugo Chavez might try to keep them alive so that he has that leverage chip on his hand, that he could play the spoiler, right? But this is all speculation, John.
Speculation and a very interesting story. Naomi Darenblum is a professor of Latin American politics and development at the New School. Thank you very much.
Now time for more headlines from Femi. Okay, Femi.
Hello there, Adora. 21 minutes to the hour. On the campaign trail, Obama will be in Nevada as he continues a swing through the desert southwest this week. Senator Hillary Clinton will be in Montana, and John McCain is scheduled to deliver a speech at the University of Denver in Colorado. The International Atomic Agency has released a report saying that they don't know if Iran's government is pursuing nuclear technology for peaceful reasons or military ones. Earlier, we spoke to the BBC's John Line in Tehran.
I think the belief is that Iran is probably exaggerating its capacity for uranium enrichment. In a way, it's a challenge, maybe even a provocation to the West.
And that was the BBC's John Lang talking to us on The Takeaway earlier on this morning. And Iran still insists that it is pursuing peaceful nuclear development. It's another chapter in Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert's battle against corruption allegations. An American businessman suspected of giving Olmert illegal funds gave a courtroom deposition earlier on today. Demand is up at food banks across the country, but supplies and donations are down. America's Second Harvest says a recent survey showed that 99% of its food banks have seen a surge in the number of clients. And finally, several leading child welfare groups are urging an overhaul of federal laws dealing with transracial adoption. They don't believe in the colorblind approach. And that's a look at your international and domestic headlines today.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
With Stephen Dubner, the author of Freakonomics, and he also has a blog. It's very interesting. And we're talking about the beauty premium, right, John?
Well, we have a little game. I mean, this is an intriguing idea. And as Adora rightly points out, it's difficult to quantify. But certainly over long periods of time and many, many data points, you got something here, Stephen. So we decided to assemble some pictures of presidents and vice presidents, okay? Because, like, one is the boss of the other, okay? Right? That's pretty simple. And then see if the rule is violated or followed by the beauty premium precept.
So the prettier man should be president.
That would be 5% more president or something like that.
Nine.
Here is James Monroe right here and Daniel Tompkins, his vice president. Is the rule violated or followed?
It is way followed.
Way followed.
So way followed.
Monroe looks much better than Tompkins, who was often drunk as VP. He was the shortest post-vice president. He died 99 days after leaving office.
The drunkenness might account for the jowl. It's a big jowl.
Here, Adora, you do this one. This one's pretty good.
How about this one? We have John Breckinridge and President James Buchanan. We're talking 1856 to 1861.
Does this violate the rule? Or
violate,
does it...
or I think it violates the rule, actually.
I think that's a little bit of an exception.
That
it's
violates
more like...
the rule. Breckinridge
I can't say Breckinridge is a looker.
Old. He's the youngest VP in history.
Yeah.
He was an unsuccessful presidential candidate. James Buchanan, one of the worst presidents in history, at least according to some historians.
Well, it's probably because he was ugly.
Yeah, I don't know. That one's a little ambivalent. Here's one that's actually probably, well, I'll just let you decide.
Can I say something? I like how you guys are making fun of me for this.
No.
Before you're making
science.
Fun of me, and now you say, let's have two data points and make it happen.
Yeah, this is science.
I love that.
This is serious
science. This is science.
Okay. Herbert Hoover, okay, you recognize him there, his vice president, Charles Curtis. Does this violate the rule or what?
I think Charles Curtis is very handsome in a kind of Panama hat salesman kind of way.
This is 1925 to 1929, yep. And the reason why I keep throwing the dates in is because obviously the notion of what beauty
right.
is changes over time.
All right, here's one. I'm dying to see what you think. Harry Truman, okay, and his vice president, Albin William Barkley.
It upholds the premise.
Truman is
a good looking man.
Truman,
come on,
over Barkley.
Yeah, plus.
All right.
Yeah.
I've got the number one massive rule blaster.
Yeah.
Okay. You know what it is?
Yep.
You got to know what it is.
Yeah, you do know what it is. And I should tell everyone.
Americans
should
know
what it is. These pictures will be on our website, so you can take a look and judge for yourself.
All right. President and vice president, who's more handsome? Who gets the beauty premium? George H.W. Bush and Dan Quayle, who John McCain said of, I can't believe a guy that handsome wouldn't have some impact.
Dan Quayle is good looking, but don't forget, George Bush was tall. Right? We haven't even compared
so tall,
height and beauty
tall
to him.
Beauty.
Boy, it sure did in that case, man.
Do you have any proof of that, Stephen?
I have proof in my briefcase. I'm not capable of sharing it with you right now, but I do,
proof.
Yeah.
This picture is proof. So if you or any of your vice presidents have experienced the beauty premium problem in your professional life, please leave your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or you can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. When we come back, real serious science, okay? Stephen Dubner, stay with us.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. Whatever you do, don't have us do all the talking. You can join the conversation at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. You can email us. Someone's already given us a response about the death of Sidney Pollack, which we'll be talking about in a moment. But this is a great moment, a great week for science. The Phoenix lander is on Mars in the polar region. Next month, the Large Hadron Super Collider is going to come online in Europe and explore the early moments of the universe. On this week of science, it is great to invite into the studio Brian Greene, who's the author of The Elegant Universe and The Fabric of the Cosmos, two fabulous books on physics. He is a physicist. He's the author of those books and also the co-founder of the World Science Festival that begins here in New York this week. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you.
Stephen Dubner, co-author of Freakonomics and author of the Freakonomics blog, is still with us.
I'm here, too.
And Adora, of course, is with us, yes. And she's a physicist as well. but this is a great week for science. I mean, you got the Phoenix lander on Mars. Next month, the super collider goes into operation if they don't blow a fuse in Europe. This is a great moment for physics and science. What's your view on the super collider? Giant new mysteries will be unraveled?
Oh, I think there's a tremendous possibility that things that we've thought about for decades may be confirmed, And even more exciting, things that we can't even imagine may appear in the data. So we're recreating conditions unseen since a trillionth of a second after the beginning of time.
And that involves basically creating giant, enormous energies to duplicate, as you say, the initial moments of the Big Bang.
That's right. You have protons that go around a tunnel that's about 15 miles in circumference. They go around near the speed of light, 99.99% the speed of light. They go around that tunnel 11,000 times per second, slammed together in 600 million collisions per second. In that debris, we're going to look for clues about how the universe began and how matter is composed.
Do you think the dispute over whether superstring theory is valid is going to be resolved by the, there are like 6 books on superstring theory is hogwash and 6 books saying it's actually describes the universe, but there's no way to test it until this comes online.
And first, explain what that is.
String theory?
Mm-hmm.
It's a theory that tries to answer a question that Albert Einstein put forward decades ago, which is there a unified theory of everything, a single equation, a single principle that might describe the big, the small, and everything in between, maybe with one idea?
Magnetism, electricity, gravity, all those forces, can they be described together?
Put them all together. And this idea of string theory has come along in the last couple of decades, and there's a chance, I call it a long shot possibility, that you might test it in this new experiment.
Well, you know, bringing you on the program is fascinating to me for another reason, and that is, you know, looking, you know, I read your book when it first came out, and it seems to me you are in a pantheon of writers who speak to the lay population about sophisticated issues in science. And if you look back to the 1800s, science was part of pop culture back in the 1800s. In the 20th century, it kind of morphed into an expert elite of hyper-specialization. And now we're seeing, and it's something of the focus of your festival, that science, because of the urgency of global warming and energy and other issues, nuclear issues that we've talked about on this program, people are yearning to understand science so they can understand these issues that are relevant to them. It's a whole different world.
That's absolutely right. There's kind of a turning away from science in the public sphere during the last 50, 75 years or so. And we're really trying to help return science to the public, both, of course, through general level books, but also through this World Science Festival of ours that'll bring 40 spectacular events covering science from neuroscience to physics to cosmology, sustainability, to general audiences across New York from May 29 to June 1st.
And tell us a little bit more about the festival. Are there going to be presentations? Is it going to be lectures? Is it for all ages?
It's for kids and adults, and I really stress that it's for both. It's not just one or the other. We have a youth and family program that's going to have Science of Imagination with Disney, Science of Sports, have kids come in to see sports heroes and learn about the underlying ideas in the science. We also have things like Illuminating Genius, a program with Bill T. Jones, Michael York, Matthew Ritchie, and neuroscientists to try to figure out creativity in the brain. What does it look like with imaging?
Bill T. Jones is beautiful.
Absolutely.
He is really awesomely beautiful. So that brings us to your point. Except you're not in the festival, right?
Because I'm not in the festival.
This is a sort of a B-level science.
I'm not qualified, but I do have a question for Brian.
Sure.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, yeah. So
I want to know how reliable we think fMRI experimentation is. So a lot of economists and others, they put magnetic resonance image. They put a person into a tube, they call it, and show them images or give them sensations and see how they respond. And from this, try to generalize psychological and economic.
They're looking at the brain.
Looking at the brain.
That's right.
Right.
It's a very coarse measure right now, as I think everybody would agree. But it's spectacular now that we can look into the brain and see it light up when certain emotions are being felt or certain ideas are being thought. Now, 100 years from now, people will look back on this as really the very, very coarsest approach. But as in any field, you have to start at the beginning and build. So, you know, in this program of ours, you know, it'd be great to see, you know, the brain of Bill T. Jones versus the brain of somebody else and try to get a sense of, well, where's the creative spark? Can you locate it in the brain? It's coarse, but it's beginning.
But hasn't that evolved, though? Because, I mean, you're talking about a CAT scan could first take a look at the brain, and then you had the MRI, and now you have the fMRI, right, which is just more detail, and you would expect that there would be mechanisms that will be even more detailed as we move
on. And there's
forward.
One coming online, the PET fMRI, which is going to combine technologies. So certainly that is the way science progresses. You start with, you know, a sledgehammer, and then you get to, you know, a fine scalpel. And that's really where we're going.
But I think, you know, the trend really is that people are going to understand these evolutions as they develop. And I think there is more of a popularization of science as it's happening that even makes your festival possible at this point. I mean, the trend is already starting to reverse. People are embracing science and trying to understand science in scientific terms.
We certainly see that happening, but we want to broaden the population that's excited about science. So many people still do think of it as intimidating and cold. But if science is presented the right way, it really is exciting, inspirational, compelling, educational, of course, entertaining, and that's what the festival programs are all about. There are 40 programs, worldsciencefestival.com, you can see it all laid out, and there's some great things
happening.
You are
the third person in as many days who's like sort of waxed like crazy enthusiastic about science on this program. I think we're branding ourselves as the like scientist going ape over something. Brian, thanks for joining us. Stay with us, because we're going to remember now somebody who I think is important in a different realm of culture. As you probably know, Brian and Stephen, one of the consummate stars of modern Hollywood, died this morning. Sidney Pollack, director Sidney Pollack, producer Sidney Pollack, actor Sidney Pollack, all equally powerful, challenging performances, themes, and great, great movies that he was responsible. He began as an actor on stage and television in the 50s. In the 60s, the film They Shoot Horses, Don't They established him as a director. And this moment here from the movie Tootsie, I think, is memorable to everyone, where Sidney Pollack is playing an actor opposite Dustin Hoffman, who convinced him to even do the flick.
I can't even send you up for a commercial. You played a tomato for 30 seconds. They want a half a day over schedule because you wouldn't sit down.
Yes, it wasn't logical.
You were a tomato! A tomato doesn't have logic! A tomato can't move!
That's what I said!
Sidney Pollack playing Dustin Hoffman's agent in Tootsie, an amazing, amazing movie. 1982, after he'd been established as a director.
Was it 1982?
Yeah, 20 years he didn't act.
Like it was so long ago.
It was 1985, of course. His big directorial success was Out of Africa. You remember that movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's so interesting about him is anybody over 20 years old who likes to go to the movies has had to have seen at least one of Sidney Pollack's movies.
Well, and his face is so iconic. His voice is so iconic. And the style of his movie, here's Meryl Streep and Robert Redford in Out of Africa.
The time you won your town the race, we cheered you through the marketplace. Man and boy stood cheering by as home we brought you, shoulder high. Smart lad, to slip betimes away from fields where glory does not stay.
I think he was nominated something like 28 times for Oscars in his various roles. He won twice.
Well, he made his career in the end as a producer, being one of the most powerful producers and certainly credible producers in Hollywood, responsible for The Quiet American, The Talented Mr. Ripley,
Michael Clayton,
and Sensibility, Searching for Bobby Fischer. And Michael Clayton, which we have actually a clip from, was his last performance, and the Oscar-winning movie, or the Oscar-nominated movie, was
George
the movie
Clooney.
He produced with George Clooney.
We don't straighten the settlement out in the next 24 hours, they're going to withhold $9 million in fees. Then they're going to pull out the video of Arthur doing his flash dance in Milwaukee. They're going to sue us for legal malpractice. Except there won't be anything for them to win, because by then the merger with London will be dead and we'll be selling off furniture.
Sidney Pollack and Michael Clayton, thanks for all those moments in the movie theater. We should point out of Africa won Best Director and Best Picture for Sidney Pollack. His death was announced late last night of cancer. He was 73. We also want to thank Stephen Dubner and Brian Green for joining us. And thanks to you for keeping your comments coming at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
And we're going to continue following the story of Iran, so you can take a look for that. Take a look for that on our website, and also you can play the game of presidential hot or not by guessing which face is the president and which only made Veep.
That's right, and you know it's all about the beauty premium, which we're going to investigate and get to the bottom of. So much more at thetakeaway.org. We're always on.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.